If you would, turn with me to Matthew 14. Matthew 14. Starting in verse 22. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost!" And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now keep your finger there and turn over to Mark chapter 6. Because we're going to go back to Matthew in a second. Mark 6, starting in verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. Now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he, Jesus, was alone on the land. Then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. Now about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea, and would have passed them by. And when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost, and cried out, for they all saw him and were troubled. But immediately he talked with them and said to them, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased, and they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled, for they had not understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened. And verse 53, when they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret and anchored there. Have you ever been in a situation where you felt like you were in great resistance? I mean, you were trying to go a certain direction and you just felt like you know everything was going wrong. You just couldn't go that direction. My wife and I, about a little over 3 years ago now, we decided to go over to England. We felt the Lord was calling us to go there to become missionaries. And arriving there, we thought, well, I've got to get a work visa now so I can get a job. And so we started the initial plans of trying to get a work visa. So I went to London to the immigration office there, and they said, "Oh, you should have got this in the United States. We can't give you one in London and or in England. So you'll either have to go back to the United States, or some people go to Europe to get it." So I was like, well, okay. So we talked about going to Europe, and we did that. We went over to Luxembourg because there was a British embassy there, and Juliet had some friends there. So we flew over there, and didn't have a lot of money left, so we were kind of running out of money, but we knew we wanted to get this visa. Got to Luxembourg and got a hotel, and went to the British embassy the next day, and this lady there, who we had called ahead, but she didn't get back to us, but she said, "Oh, you know, I tried to call you guys to tell you not to come, because we have absolutely no way to see you until, like, January. It's November. You know, we're just completely booked until January." And so she said, "We can't help you, you know." She said, "But you could go to Dusseldorf, Germany, because there's a big British embassy there, and you could get maybe a visa there." So we're like, "I don't know." I was ready to just take a vacation and call it quits and just say, forget it, you know. But Juliet woke up early in the morning and read Ask, Seek, and Knock, you know. And she just said, "Todd, I think we should just keep trying." So we got on a train, went all the way to Dusseldorf, Germany, and it was a very seedy place where we wound up right near the train station, stayed in this little seedy hotel, and it was a very interesting time. We arrived there on a Friday, and we couldn't go to the embassy until Monday. So we had a whole weekend at this place. We didn't know anybody, felt very alone, very scared, in a sense, not knowing what was going on, and couldn't speak the language hardly. And so we kind of waited out the weekend, and Monday we went to this British embassy. And we got there, and first we didn't have any pictures, so I spent some of our little remaining money left to get some passport pictures or whatever we needed. And so we go upstairs, and we walk in this immigration's office, and we got there early, but it was packed. I mean, it was wall-to-wall people. And we just walked in and went, oh, no, you know. We've got two kids, Juliet's pregnant, and we're supposed to, like, try to stay there the whole day. And so I filled out a form. I walk up to the front to hand in my form, and it says on there, British work visa, $1,200 American dollars. And I've got about $100 in my pocket. And I was just like, what in the world? So I just filled it out in faith, handed it in, went back, told Juliet, we're both just like, why did we come here? And so I went back and sat down, and then they called my name about 10 minutes later. And I went up, and I thought, maybe God's just going to make the money miraculously appear in my pocket, you know? I was hoping. And this guy, he says to me, why did you come here? And I said, well, they sent me here from Luxembourg, you know? And before that, they sent me here from England. And he goes, well, I don't know why. Who's telling you these things? But we can't help you at all unless you're a resident of Germany. And, you know, I felt like he took out a gun and shot me. I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. And he said, and in fact, he said, I would not even try to go back to England now because I have stamped your passport saying that you're looking for a job. And they're a little concerned over there about people just going over there and getting on the dole. And he said, I've stamped your passport saying you're looking for a job, and it's probably likely they're not even going to let you back in the country. So he said, I would just get a plane ticket from here and just go straight home. And, man, I came back and told Juliet, and we walked out of that immigration's office just depressed, just like, why in the world did we come? And so anyways, I'm going to tell you the rest of the story at the end of this. You know, it'll be like Paul Harvey's the rest of the story. But have you ever been there? You ever been trying to get to a certain place and you just keep running into problems? Well, that's kind of what we see here in Matthew 14. The history, just prior to all this happening, Jesus had been in the region of Galilee, up in Capernaum there. And that was his hometown. He had done some miracles. He healed Jairus' daughter, the woman with the issue of blood. Remember that? And then he decided, hey, I'm going to go and see my family back in Nazareth. So he went all the way across the Sea of Galilee, took a road over to Nazareth, and he hung out in Nazareth for a while. And in Nazareth, he met with some resistance himself in that the people wouldn't believe him, and he could do no mighty works there. Not because his power was limited, but I think because they didn't bring anybody to him to be healed. And so he had spent some time in Nazareth and with his disciples, and then they came back to Galilee to a deserted place. And when they got there, there was a multitude of people awaiting them. And Jesus, you know, said to his disciples, hey, where are we going to get food for all these people to eat? And the disciples said, it would take a year's wages. What are you talking about? We've got 5 loaves and 2 fish here. And he says, that'll be good. Bring them here, you know. And so he does this miracle and he feeds all these people. And after he had fed them all, he put his disciples in a boat and said, okay, you guys head over to Bethsaida, which was on probably the opposite side of the Sea of Galilee. And I think that he sent them directly into this struggle that they were about to be heading into. Because the funny thing is they don't wind up in Bethsaida. They wind up in Gennesaret, which is not straight across. It's kind of to the left a bit, and or to the west. So, anyways, his disciples get in a boat, and that's where we pick up in Matthew 14, 22. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was there alone, but the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. So here they are. They go out. You know, I don't know if they had got to about the middle of the lake when the wind hit. I don't know, you know. But it was such a direct wind that they weren't able to sail it. I don't know. I don't know a lot about sailing, but I know that if you're trying to go directly into the course of the wind, it's difficult. You have to tack and tack and tack and tack, and not only that, they had. It says that the waves were tossing the boat. So I mean, there's probably some good-sized waves, and when you're trying to tack across waves, it's difficult. You can get the boat can get sideways on you, or it could even capsize. So they had got out the oars, and they were struggling with the oars. So it was a struggle. And it's interesting, it says that in that passage we read in Mark, that their hearts were hard over the bread. They hadn't understood about this miracle that Jesus did with the bread. It said their hearts were hard. And it says in the Word that God resists the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. So it's interesting that here they have these hard hearts. They were resistant to this miracle that God, that Jesus had done, and God turns around and sends them into resistance. They resist God, and He sends them into resistance. It was kind of an affliction, if you might say. So why did they have hard hearts? I was thinking about this. You know, why would they have hard hearts? Could it be that they just came from Nazareth and they saw that He didn't do any mighty works? I don't know. Or was it just a refusal to believe? Have you ever met anybody who says, well, you know, I asked God to do a certain thing and He didn't do it, so He doesn't exist. You know, kind of that sort of mentality. I was watching a BBC production on dinosaurs recently with my son, and they were going through the different periods of history, you know, Triassic and Jurassic or whatever it was. And anyways, they said they had gone into this new era, and they said, and in this era, flowers have now appeared. And then they said, and bees too. And I thought, well, gosh, wasn't that a great thing that the flowers and the bees just happened to pop into existence at the exact same time so they could work together? Isn't that just a great coincidence? You know, but they don't see that. You know, it's like this refusal to believe. And I don't know, maybe that's why they had a hard heart. They didn't want to believe it, because sometimes when we're faced with the reality of God, we're resistant, because we know that if we're going to accept Him or accept His ways, it means we might have to change. And I think that maybe sometimes people don't want to change, and so they're going to refuse to believe. In the struggles of rowing that boat, they may have wondered where He was. He wasn't with them. But we know in Mark 6:48 that He was watching them. And you might be in a struggle right now, but you can know that He sees you. He sees you in that struggle. And you know, He let them struggle a long time. It says it was the fourth watch of the night before He showed up. That's between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. in the morning. So, if you can imagine, they left at the end of the day. You know, maybe it was 7, 8 p.m., I don't know. And now it's between 3 and 6 in the morning, and they're only in the middle of the lake. And I bet they were wet. I bet they were tired. I bet they were grumpy. I bet that they might have been a bit frustrated. Why in the world did Jesus send us this way anyway? This is frustrating. Why do we have to go to Bethsaida? Why isn't He with us? And yet, it was His very direction that put Him in that situation. But He's leading them into this resistance so He can display His power. And that's what we see in verses 25 through 27. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw Him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost!" And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." So Jesus comes walking on what they're struggling against. I mean, to them, it's a struggle. I mean, they're rowing and rowing, spending all this energy, and Jesus just comes walking on it. You know, I wondered, was he hopping over the waves, or were the waves kind of parting in between him, you know, so he could just kind of walk through them? Did his feet get wet? I don't know, you know. If he was walking on the water, I don't know, maybe they didn't. But here he is, he's walking on what they're struggling against. It reminds me of Colossians chapter 1. Why don't we look at that real quick? Colossians 1. And I've lost the passage. Yeah, here it is. 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. Here he's walking on water. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist. Or the word there could also be translated held together. You know, and so, you know, Jesus just was holding those atoms a little tighter together and walking right on them. So he showed his disciples that he had power over matter. He was breaking bread, making it multiply. And here, he's showing that he has power over the elements, power over power, power over the wind, power over these waves, power over this water. And it's all things that the disciples are familiar with. They're familiar with the wind. They're familiar with the waves. They're familiar with storms and so forth. And here he comes walking on it. I thought of that scripture, through our God we shall do valiantly. It is he who treads down our enemies. And Jesus was treading right across those waves. Now it's interesting, they thought it was a ghost. They thought it was a ghost. It was something scary from the past. And you know, maybe you're in a situation in your life right now where you're in a struggle, and suddenly God's brought something new, and you're saying, is it a ghost? But maybe it's the Lord, and he's saying, be of good cheer, it is I, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. So he met them in this weary struggle. And let's go on, verses 28 to 31. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So he said, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? Now in verse 28 there, you kind of question whether Peter really knew if it was the Lord. Lord, if that's really you, bid me to come. You know, was he sure that it was Jesus, or is he still kind of wondering if it's a ghost? You know, it's dark. It's 3 a.m. There's probably moonlight out, because obviously Jesus was able to see them straining at the oars. So there was some light. But, you know, Peter calls out, hey, if that's you, bid me to come. And, you know, Peter was famous for always saying things that maybe he regretted. And I think maybe he regretted this, because then Jesus says one word, come. You know, oh, man, you know. I didn't want him to say that, you know. It was funny, Juliet and I, in going down to California here, there was a time about 6 months ago where I was just going through it, you know, thinking, gosh, should we go? And I don't know, just struggling with this whole decision. And I went outside, I had to go take out the trash or something, and I came back and I said, Lord, you know, if this is really you, just tell me to come. You know, just make it so clear to me. Not really thinking about this passage at all. So we got into bed, and Juliet pulled out Streams in the Desert. Has anyone ever seen that? It's a devotional by Kalman. It's a great, great book. But anyways, the passage for that particular day was this passage. and it says, the Lord bids you come. You know, I was like, no way. So, anyway, so, you know, Jesus says, come. And I imagine Peter's heart probably dropped down into his stomach at that point. But Peter gets out, and you think about what he left to get out. He left comfort. I mean, just that he's in the boat, that's kind of comfortable. He's leaving security. That boat's a secure place in this sea. He's leaving familiarity, and he's leaving his position in that boat, and he's also leaving others behind. And, you know, I was looking at the Sea of Galilee, and they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles. And, you know, they were smack right in the middle of the Sea of Galilee at this point. And so you have to really kind of think about what Peter's going through here. This was not an easy thing to do. It's dark, there's big waves, and he's getting out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. It's a 3 or 4 mile swim in any direction. If he's wrong and they can't find him again, he's swimming for a long time. And he's already tired. He's been rowing for hours and hours. So he gets out, leaving all these things, comfort, security, familiarity, place or position, and he's leaving others behind. And sometimes taking a step of faith requires this. Sometimes it means you're going to leave comfort. Sometimes it means you're going to leave security. Sometimes it means you're going to leave others behind. And that's hard. You know, with any move, with any change, with any step of faith, there's always things that we can look back on and go, oh, well, gosh, maybe I should stay. What about this? And what about that? And, you know, we can see positives and negatives. I mean, it's so hard to, Ed was just talking about, you know, he's got a big decision coming up in his life, and he's got some positives and negatives. Well, you know, what do I do with these, you know? So he gets out of the boat, and he starts walking on the water towards Jesus. It's a miracle. But then, you know the story, he loses his sight of Jesus. Not that Jesus disappeared, but he turns his eyes, sees the waves, hears that wind howling, and he begins looking at the problems and not the answer. And I heard this quote this week, I loved it. Safety is not the absence of troubles, but the presence of Jesus. And that's really true. You know, we're all in a place of faith. You know, if we're working, we're believing that that job's going to be there for us tomorrow. If we're in a house, we believe that home is going to be there for us tomorrow. We believe that the economy is going to continue going the way it's going. We're all acting in faith. And when we drive down the road, we're believing in faith that the person coming towards us is going to stay in that lane that they're in and not go into our lane. So we're all walking in faith, but it's not the absence of troubles, it's the presence of Jesus. Peter, he lost his sight. He didn't look under Jesus anymore, the author and finisher of his faith. He lost sight of Jesus. He looked away, he started looking at the problems. I thought of that verse, he will keep in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. And that's true. You know, so often when we find ourselves full of the most stress and anxiety, if you just backtrack, you go, oh, that's right, I've forgotten the God part of this picture, haven't I? I've been thinking in my own strength, in my own flesh. I'm going to pull myself up by my own bootstraps and get out there and make a way, and that's when I get all worried. But if I just remember, oh yeah, God is with me. That's right, He loves me. He's for me. All things work together for the good of those that love Him. Then I can go on in faith. And I stay in peace. But Peter gets wet. As soon as he starts looking at the wind and the waves, you know, kaplunk, he goes right in. And it's interesting that Peter's step of faith led to peril. I mean, when he fell in that water, he knew he was in trouble. I mean, he was obviously a swimmer. It wasn't that he couldn't swim, because remember when, after the resurrection, he saw Jesus at the shore, and he said, it's the Lord, and he took off his outer garment, and he plunged into the sea and swam to Jesus. So he could swim, but there was something about this that really scared him. I mean, it's dark, big waves, middle of the sea. He knows it's a long swim. So he cries out one of the shortest prayers in all the Bible, Lord, save me. And Jesus was there to catch him. But his step of faith, it led to peril. It put him in danger, at least in that moment. Now, Jesus grabbed him, said, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And I don't know if Jesus kind of dragged him back to the boat or what, but you know, he helps Peter get in the boat, all wet, soaking wet, even more wet than he already was. And I wondered if Peter was embarrassed. I wondered if the other disciples were maybe snickering a bit, you know? Kind of the egg on the face thing. Oh, look at Peter, you know, he really blew it this time. But you know, the real tragedy here is not that Peter had a lack of faith and fell in the water, but the real tragedy is that the other 11 disciples, I don't know if there were 12 in the boat, but the other disciples didn't get out too. Peter was the only one who left the boat. And so he's really to be commended. He was the only one who walked on the water, aside from Christ. But, a step of faith may lead to an embarrassing peril. It may mean that others might snicker. It may mean that you wind up a little bit embarrassed. But in the end, you'll be justified. I knew a man in England, still know him, and he was a religious education. Do they have that here in Canada, religious education or no? In the schools, school systems? Well, in England they have an actual position, teaching position of religious education. So he was an RE teacher. And he was faithful in this job for 25 years, something like that. In 10 years he was the head of the department. And at the end of that time, 24th year or so, they got a new headmaster at the school, a woman. And she just did not like Norman at all. Just hated him for some reason. And Norman knew this. And anyway, she was diagnosed with cancer. And Norman probably, you know, just felt like the Lord was prompting him to write a letter to her stating that, you know, this is the Lord and he's disciplining you. And you just need to, you know, he's done this in my life too, and you need to repent and turn from your sin and give your life to the Lord. And so he wrote her that letter, and she was mad about that letter, and she dismissed him. And so he took it to court because he felt like it was wrongful dismissal. And it wasn't that quick. I mean, he went through batteries of what do you call it when you have another person come into the classroom and observe you to make sure you're doing things right. He went through batteries of that. Just all these, he's being written up, and I mean, she was just out to get him. And so finally dismissed him, and so he took that to court, and I was in the courtroom, and man, these judges, they didn't like Norman either. Poor guy, you know, it was like, first of all, Ken Sutton found him a lawyer who was a guy from Africa. He could barely speak English. And he's a big, big black guy. And so anyway, the first day, the court proceedings are going on, and this black guy takes this headmaster to question her, and he finds out that she says that she's a Christian. And he says, she was living with a man at the time. He said, "Is it right, is it Christian to live with another man?" Right in front of everyone, in front of the whole court. And she turned bright red. And the judges were just fuming. And from that day, I think they had made their decision that Norman was going to lose. But to make a long story short, he lost that case. And it was a very discouraging thing. It was embarrassing for him. It was, it looked like egg on the face kind of thing. And yet, I've recently come to find out that he got a new position as the head of his department in a different school. He has a much larger income. He has also a much larger amount of money that he can use to buy books and materials and things like that. So it was neat that, you know, even though it looked like defeat, it was victory at the end. So Peter's step of faith, you know, he knew Jesus in a way that they didn't know Jesus, the other disciples. Playing it safe is an illusion. You know, if Peter had said, okay, well, what are the positives and negatives of getting out of this boat? You know, and played that, you know, you can't go with logic on that one. Sometimes God calls us to take a step of faith, and it's not going to be logical. Did it make sense when he asked the servants to fill the pots up with water when they needed wine? Did that make sense? No. Did it make sense that they should go out into the deep and cast their nets on the right side of the boat when they had fished all night and caught nothing? Did that make sense? Do you catch fish in the middle of the lake in the daytime? No. So, you know, God sometimes calls us to do things that don't make sense. His ways are higher than our ways, aren't they? Well, let's go on, 32 through 34. And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, truly you are the Son of God. And when they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret. So they willingly received him into the boat. Did you see that? It's in Mark that it says that they willingly received him. Or it's either in Mark or John. Let's see. Mark 6. Let me see if I can find that. No, it must be in John. Well, I won't go there, but it does say that they willingly received him into the boat. There was no more resistance there. Their hearts were hard because of the bread, but now it's like there's this change. They're willingly receiving him into the boat. He gets into the boat, and immediately the wind stops, and their struggle's over. And then also in John it says immediately they were at land where they were going. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. Here they're struggling and struggling and struggling. As soon as they willingly receive Jesus into the boat, they're at their destination. And so it is with us. You know, we arrive when we go from resistance to willingness. When we stop resisting the Lord and say, okay, Lord, you know, you do what you want to do. That's when we arrive. That's when things really take off. So a question today that I had is God putting something on your heart, or is he proving himself to you and yet are you resisting him? Is there something in your life maybe he's calling you to do and yet you're resisting him? And maybe it's time to willingly receive him. Maybe it's time to, maybe it's that friend that God has been saying, hey, I want you to witness to that friend, and you haven't done that yet. I keep reminding you about that. Are you going to do that? Are you going to resist me on that? Maybe it's a relative. Maybe it's a ministry. Maybe God has put something on your heart that you want to do in this church, and there's some resistance there. It's a two-way street. God's not going to make you take a step of faith. He's not going to force that on you. You're going to have to, and I'm going to have to take steps too. And you know, He'll give me what I need for the courage to take the step. But he's not going to make me take the step. He'll give me enough evidence to take the step of faith. So, in conclusion, what do I do now? What if perhaps you're not a Christian here today and you're resisting him? You know, you've had certain circumstances in your life where you know, hey, that was the Lord. And yet, you're just not willing to finally say, okay, I give up. I want you to be the Lord of my life. I don't want to just be playing a game anymore. I want you to be the Lord. Or perhaps the Lord is calling you to take that step of faith. And you've been in a struggle for a long time now, and now he's showed up. And you're thinking, whoa, this is a ghost. But it's the Lord. It is I. Be of good cheer. It is I. Don't be afraid. Take that step of faith. Well, what if you can't? What if you're like, oh, I just can't do it? Well, it says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord and he'll lift you up. He gives grace to the humble. He resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So it's just a matter of just being honest. Lord, I think you're calling me to do this. I've prayed this prayer so many times. Lord, I think you're calling us to go to California, but I'm not sure. I'm a little scared about this. I see some good things about staying here. It's kind of scary going down there. It's so expensive. I don't have a job. We don't have a place to live. Lord, are you sure? You know, just admitting, I'm scared, Lord. I'm afraid about finances. I feel like I'm too weak to make this decision. You're going to have to fill me with courage if you want me to take this step. Because I don't have the courage. I don't have the strength to do this. It's just a matter of being honest. And it's a matter of doing it as often as you need to. You know, pray it again and again and again if you need to pray it again and again and again. Well, in terms of the rest of the story, we were there in Dusseldorf. We took a very sorrowful train ride back to Luxembourg, where we were going to catch a plane back to England. And we called back to the States and talked to some friends and some family. And some of them were saying, well, when you go back to England, don't say anything about this and just lie. Just say, you know, you're just planning on just being a tourist for the next 6 months. You know, don't tell them that you're here to start a church or anything like that, which was our intent at the time. And I was like, no, I can't do that. You know, that's lying. I don't want to do that, you know. And so we're just praying, asking the Lord what to do. And we just went ahead and in faith got on that plane. They let us on the plane and flew to England and had to go through immigration there in England. And we just said, Lord, if you want us to stay in England, you're just going to have to do a miracle here. So we walked down to the immigrations officer, and I had determined I was going to be absolutely honest. And I went right up to that immigrations officer, and I said, yep, we were just in Europe trying to get a work visa. Weren't able to get it. We weren't able to get it. And we want to start a church here. That's why we're here, and I want to get work and so forth. And this girl goes, well, she said, I really think you're going to need a job for that, but I'll go ahead and give you another six-month tourist visa. And so she stamped us in, and we were in, you know. And then it was about 6 months later that we met Ken Sutton and wound up here. So anyway, it's been a great adventure of faith, and we are presently planning on maybe going back into the mission field. And we're praying about Italy right now. So we met a fellow in England, and he has a real heart for Italy, and we're praying about going over there together. So if you remember us, please pray for us. And I just want to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak to you. And thank you, Brent, for the opportunity.